information I gave you is found in the Way of God, Baruchata, chapter 2. And so far as I know, isn't found anyplace else. There's another explanation which is found everywhere, including other works of the Tata. So, for the sake of your general education, I want to fill you in what the other explanation is and how the two explanations fit together. Let's just review very briefly. God created the world in order to express loving kindness. To express loving kindness means to do good, to give good, to benefit. Because he's perfect, he will give the greatest good. The greatest good is himself. So what he will create is as much of himself as can be created. Not all of him can be created, but whatever of him that can be created, that's what he's going to create. An essential element in himself is that he is totally self-determined. So the creature that he creates should be self-determined as much as a creature can be. And that's why the creature has the greatest good that a creature can have. Free will is how the creature can be partly self-determined. That was the explanation of why there is free will. Now, in another book called the Das Tunos, Understanding Heart in English, this one is translated, and in many other places, you hear the following explanation. God wants to give the greatest possible good, wants to benefit, but it is a feature of human experience that when you are given something that you don't deserve, you don't fully enjoy it. Because when you're given something you don't deserve, there's a sense, an understanding, a feeling of unworthiness, a loss of dignity, a loss of self-respect. We would call it, I guess, patronizing. And therefore, if God would just give it to us, this good, it would come with a tinge of pain. The pain of loss of dignity, loss of self-respect, being patronized. So in order that this good that God gives should be fully good, without any blemish, without any shortcoming, God gives us an opportunity to earn it, so that when we finally get it, we'll get what we earned. And then, we will deserve it. It'll be ours by right. And it will be with dignity, and with self-respect, with honor, we might say. And then we'll fully enjoy it. There won't be any tinge of pain. And that will make it more perfect. This is based on a statement in the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi says, he who eats that which is not his own is embarrassed to look in the face of the giver. He's embarrassed. So according to this explanation, that embarrassment is uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable. It's painful. God wants to give a good that will be as perfect as the good that the creature can have to be. So he gives the creature the opportunity to earn it. By earning it, he frees it from that blemish, from that pain. Now, at first glance, this sounds like that's a mixed metaphor. But anyway, this sounds like an entirely different explanation. The first explanation that I gave you last week said nothing about pain, said nothing about being hurt or embarrassment. Didn't say anything about that. The experience of it never came into it. And now all of a sudden that's become the essence of the explanation of why we have free will. So this does sound like two entirely different ideas.
If we earn a reward, then doesn't that mean that it's not like real chesed that Hashem is doing for us, and it's something that He's obligated to give us?
Okay, this is a very important point. He says, if we earn the reward, where's the chesed? If we really earn it, we really deserve it. We really deserve it. So then, where's the chesed in it? And here's the answer. I used to put this in, but since you asked, I'll put it in now. I'm going to put it better. Tzedaka, charity, is a very important mitzvah. There are different ways that you can do charity. The Rambam had 8 different levels of charity. Number 7, next to the best, is where the giver does not know the receiver, and the receiver does not know the giver. That way, there's no embarrassment. Neither side knows the other. It's totally anonymous. But there's one that's even better than that. What's the highest form of charity, the most perfect form of charity?
Maybe when the receiver doesn't know he's receiving.
Doesn't know he's receiving. That would be good. That's logically, he's right. He's right. But the receiver doesn't know he's even receiving. Mitzvah. Okay, but that'll reduce the charity to a very, very super small number of cases. What about the charity you do for living people? Not the charity you do for the dead. Yeah?
When you teach him a trade so he can earn his own living.
Yeah. That's the answer to your question. That's how you give it to him, and in a way that he doesn't know that he's receiving. But it's not quite the same. Not quite the same. Now listen to what this gentleman said. You give him a job, or teach him a trade, and he knows how to earn his own living. You enable him to earn his own living. Now, in spiritual terms, in moral terms, in psychological terms, this is a subtle matter. I mean, it's an everyday occurrence, but it's a subtle matter. Because a job is a very precious thing. I mean, I know you're not looking forward to the day when you have to work. But when you need to work and when you need to support a family, a job is a very precious thing. People without work are in a terrible, terrible suffering and deprived position. Now let's imagine that A gives B a job. Is B grateful? Tremendously grateful. Tremendously great. On the other hand, as he points out, at the end of the week, when B collects his paycheck, he earned it. He worked for it. Indeed, assuming that it's an honest job, not just a phony setup so to keep B occupied, by working for A, B created more profit for A than his salary. That's what jobs are supposed to do. So when B collects his paycheck at the end of the week, there's no embarrassment. There's no embarrassment. Here, the giver and the recipient know each other. They know each other. And the recipient is grateful, and there's no embarrassment. It's an amazing thing. He's been given a gift, and yet the gift doesn't undermine his self-respect. It doesn't undermine his dignity. Because the gift is precisely the opportunity to earn the benefit that comes at the end of the week. The gift is precisely the opportunity to earn. That will be the expression of the chesed. The expression of loving kindness is that you give to the recipient an opportunity to acquire something, to achieve something by dint of his own effort, so that what he gets and enjoys at the end, he earned and has no embarrassment in receiving and enjoying. And that, in our view, will be the highest chesed. The highest possible chesed, because it's the most complete. According to the second explanation. Okay? Now, this second explanation is subject to an objection. I would say almost every time I presented this to a class, to a shir, someone thinks of the objections. There is a fairly obvious objection to this second explanation. Let me go through it again and see if it doesn't leap to the front of your screen. Why doesn't God just give it to us? Sort of like you feed a horse. You put the horse in front of the hay, and he eats the hay. He doesn't care whether he earns it or he didn't earn it. Just eats it, enjoys it. No, but human beings aren't like that. Human beings are... Their psychology is such that if you give them something they didn't earn, then they feel compromised. They feel it's a handout. They feel that it's implied that they're incompetent. So, they want to be able to earn it. But if they earn it, then they feel much better about it. This is tremendously true. It's true psychologically. It's something you earn for yourself. You have a much greater enjoyment of it. There are people who are naturally thin. They can eat anything and everything. It makes absolutely no difference. They just stay thin. Okay, I'm sure they're happy to be thin. They're not as happy as I am. But I have to work to be thin. If I eat, I'm very fat. I have been fat. And I have lost it. And I'm behind about doing reasonably well, staying in a reasonable way. But it takes an effort. And I'm very happy to be at a reasonable weight because I'm doing it for myself. That's true for everything. So, that's why God gives us the opportunity to earn it. So we'll be able to have our dignity, our self-respect, and enjoy it fully. Now, there's a fairly obvious objection to this story here. Yeah, it's going to disappoint me. All right, so you have more experience than anyone. You heard it before at least three times. Doesn't it jump to your mind? I gave you the contrast of the horse. Can't you build something out of that?
I read it somewhere.
What did you read?
World Maps.
Ah, maybe. I read that's not the end of this question. Yeah. So what did you say? Good? Reading's not too bad.
Then why didn't God make this in a way where we wouldn't feel ashamed?
That's right. That's right. This is all a matter of how we're built psychologically. So why did he make us like horses? Indeed. Just make us so we won't feel embarrassed when he gives it to us. The whole point of this world, with all its pain and suffering, is that when we get there, we shouldn't feel embarrassed by getting something we didn't earn. Well, cut out the embarrassment, cut out the earning, and go straight. Just make us horses. Now, in the context of that explanation, I don't think there's an answer to that question. That's a terrific question. Friedlander mentions it in his commentaries on Ramchal. But in logic, it's an obvious question. Now, the greatness of the answer in the Derech Hashem, in the way of God, is that it answers that question. Because it's not based on unhappiness at all. Not based on embarrassment at all. It's an entirely different explanation. It's an explanation of receiving and appropriating the greatest possible good. The greatest possible good is the greatest possible God-likeness. To be God-like, you have to be self-determined. Free will is how you're self-determined. Nothing over there has anything to do with feeling embarrassed. Dignity and self-respect doesn't come into the description at all. So, that, the answer that I gave you last week, explanation I gave you last week, answered that question. The only problem left is, how do the two explanations fit together? Since Ramchal himself uses the explanation of embarrassment in the Das Tunos. It can't be that they're not related to one another. And it is based on a Yerushalmi, and everybody else uses the other explanation of an embarrassment. So there's got to be some logical relationship between the explanations. Yes?
Maybe there's some sort of connection between being godlike and being having this sort of pain embarrassment when you get a hand in something. The brain that we weren't created in that way wouldn't be able to appreciate all the goodness.
Okay, in logic, that is a right move. That's the right direction in which to go. I don't know how you would fill that out in detail, but you're right. Your mind works well. That's the right way to put things together to try to find a solution. I have a solution in a different direction, but you're absolutely right. That's one right way to go. You've got to find some necessity for the feeling, so that the explanation of the feeling will be relevant as well. Maybe what I'm doing is on the same line, actually. Maybe you're right. That's a good suggestion. The way I see it is this, that the explanation in the way of God is the real explanation. That's the deep explanation. That you're acquiring as much of God's goodness that a creature can have. And that the experience, the emotion of embarrassment, is just a symptom of the fact that the soul is not getting that. When the soul receives without earning it, then the soul is not self-determined. The soul is squirrel-like, just getting it handed on a flag of the squirrel. The soul is horse-like, eating its hay. The soul, which is a chelik elokam imal, which is a piece of God on high, knows that it is not receiving the great good of which it's capable. And it feels compromised. What we experience as embarrassment and a loss of dignity and self-respect, actually, as I'm saying the words, I'm realizing that really, I'm really saying it your way. I think you're right. I think you're right. These are the words I always say to people, but I think you put it well. The soul, in terms of its being a piece of God on high, and thereby being capable of having some of God's nature, some of God's being in it, if it's receiving without deserving, without earning, it knows it isn't seeing that. So it knows that its inherent nature is being compromised. And that's what we experience in terms of dignity and self-respect. This is just the clothing on it. This is the way it's interpreted in our framework of living in this world and interpersonal relations and jobs and vacations and so forth and so on. But really, the feeling is the external symptom of the soul being compromised in its essence, not achieving the God-likeness of which it's capable. I think that's the idea. Now, let me just add one final idea, and then I'll take your questions. Now, my oldest son, who I keep quoting, just pointed out, if you read that in Yerushalmi, maybe we're emphasizing the wrong word. Yerushalmi says, he who eats what is not his own is embarrassed to look the giver in the face. So what do we emphasize? We emphasize embarrassed. We thought of embarrassment as a pain. And as a pain, it makes the enjoyment and all of all less. He said, maybe what you ought to emphasize is that he can't look the giver in the face. Looking the giver in the face is the most profound attachment that you can have. A face-to-face interaction is the most profound interaction you can have. If you go to somebody, you want to talk to them, and he turns his back on you, that means he doesn't want to connect with you. He doesn't want to connect. Worst is when two people turn their backs on one another. Then neither wants to connect. A real connection is a face-to-face interaction. So to say that he's embarrassed to look the giver in the face means he can't have a face-to-face connection. Because he's not on a par. They're not equals. Now, a face-to-face interaction with God, if it requires being on a par with God, so then it means being God-like. But this one is so far from being God-like, you can't have a face-to-face interaction with God. So that's the crucial thing. He's disqualified from face-to-face interaction because he isn't God-like enough to support such an interaction. Now, the Yerushalmi says the idea in the way of God. Embarrassment part is not the essential idea. I think that was a great comment. I can say it without prejudice. Maybe. I'm going to use myself, but it's a beautiful, beautiful idea. And anyway, that then is going to be the explanation. The real explanation is what we have in the way of God. The other one is only an emotional expression of it. Questions? Yeah.
How does, in
if that's the case, how does earning something, how does the process of putting in effort to achieve something, or whatever it is, aspect of being given, how does that make us emulate our chef?
Okay, let's say this, I think I said less, but let's say it again. The difference here is going to be this. Hashem is whatever he is because of himself.
Oh, okay.
Right. He's self-determined. Now, if I look at the squirrel who gets the nuts because God gave them, I say, why did he have nuts? Because God gave them to him. They're not essential to him. They don't belong to him. When I earn something, it is in that sense mine. Why do I have it? Because I earned it. Not because it came from outside. So that much we then share with God. And it's mine because of me, not mine because of something outside of me. That's the element of connection.
That's also, we do things, we put in effort, it's an illusion that we have that we build for ourselves. In that respect, we actually haven't benefited ourselves.
Okay, but it's a compromise. Because had we not put in the effort, we wouldn't have gotten it even as a gift. But this is why, as I said before, the other illustration of when you earn something, you feel much happier with it. Why? Because you know it's yours by virtue of you, not yours by virtue of something else. A kid who grows up in a rich home and inherits $1 million does not prize the $1 million nearly so much as the guy who earned $1 million. By the way, of course, you're a couple of generations further down the track, but my generation, many children were a severe disappointment to their parents because their parents worked their way up out of very low economic circumstances and sent the children to college, which for them was a big sacrifice. They didn't go to college. And a lot of the children were not particularly interested in earning money. Why? Because they took it for granted. Their parents provided them with enough. Says, well, my life is going to be earning money. But for those who didn't have, putting yourself in a position to earn money was a big success. And it could sustain a person's whole life. That made him feel like he was something. But he grew up with it. He took it for granted. He looked for something else that could be a success. Because it wasn't something that you made for yourself. Yeah, the idea.
So, what if you pray for someone that's in like a bad situation? That's like, you know, and by your praying, you're helping him. Is he so embarrassed because you sort of helping him?
I guess by praying for him, if God answers your prayer, God gives him the ability to earn more for himself. But what he gives him is the ability to earn more. And therefore, what he gets in the end is something he'll have earned. When you pray for him, it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll pray for him to get something that he didn't deserve. You may be praying for another job, for a better job. I mean, you may not think of those terms, but that's maybe what it means. In other words, let's say he's sick, and you're praying for him to become healthy. Healthy is just the opportunity to do more. So it isn't as if he'll be embarrassed by getting the help. Getting the help is like getting the job. Right? Then with the help, he can do more and earn more.
I'm thinking more of a situation where, let's say, the child's going the wrong way in life, and the father prays for the child to go the right way. He's completely going the wrong way, and the child just flips around and all of a sudden, like, starts seeing things differently. You know, is the child so embarrassed that the father has been praying day and night to try to change his son?
So this is it. It depends upon how the change takes place. If the change is in an opportunity that presents itself to the child, mm-hmm. but the child has to take the opportunity.
Right.
He has to work with it. He shouldn't be embarrassed. Be thankful that he had the opportunity to make the move and earn it. That's all. It can all go into the idea of giving a job. Once you put it under the category of giving a job, so then the embarrassment goes away. Yes?
There's a social welfare program whereby they want to take people who are receiving relief and give them work so that they don't feel perhaps the embarrassment of having to receive a handout. It also serves to the perpetuation of this from one generation to another. And that's a real problem.
It is. I think it was Clinton who instituted that in the United States. He sort of backed it and did something good. I would credit him with the foresight that he let his wife run around trying to reform the health care system for 2 years and got nothing out of it. But this was a tremendous success. And so I have to say, right, you only have to be careful that when you work, when these people take work, they don't earn $10 a month more than they would earn if they didn't work. You got to make a differential that makes it worthwhile working. Otherwise, it's ridiculous. But yes, indeed, I think that's quite true. Giving the people, the other qualification is not everybody can work. Not everyone's able to work. And they may need support without working. Whether they're physically unable or psychologically unable, emotionally unable, there are people who can't work. People who can work, you do them no favor by giving them handouts. Liberals have to learn a lesson. Yeah.
Would you agree to say that there's a component of what we get from Hashem which we don't deserve?
For the vast, vast majority of us, that's true.
Okay, so then how is that any different from giving somebody a phony job and pretending that they're actually anyone?
Well, it's a combination. You said a component. When you say a phony job, it makes it sound like it's totally phony.
Well, yeah. So part of the job, which is the majority of the job is phony, and they're actually getting paid. The actual amount they're getting paid is some of that would be for, you know, the time or...
Yeah, well, the real example here, I think, is avoiding being fired. Now, if a person's fired, he starves. Right? So what God does is he keeps us on. And he may, if we ruin the job tools, he may give us, replace the job tools. So he enables us to keep working, even though we don't deserve to keep working. But in the end, all we're going to get as the ultimate reward is what we earned by our work. So the charity that we get is only in the meantime. It's only during the working process. You have a question?
Okay. If you're helping somebody, giving them the opportunity, you're doing an act of charity. What if your job is to go into a company and figure out how to save the company money and fire as many people as you can, put a computer in there, and then do you get the opposite of charity, like, effective punishment?
Well, I mean, it's not directly related to my concerns philosophically, but it is an interesting question. Especially if people's lives are going to be an interesting question. You have to have a social policy. You have to have a social policy. Capitalism, competition guarantees that thousands of businesses will go bankrupt every year. Of course, the justification is that other businesses will produce cheaper goods and everybody will benefit. And some people are going to, in every race, there are winners and losers. You've built your whole economy on races. Now, could there be another way to build an economy? Well, the communists tried it. Collective farms and so on and so on. It was a big bust. So maybe you need a safety net so that people who go bust don't starve. But it seems that the goose that lays the golden eggs is the competition of an open economy. And then there will be losers. There's no question about it.
There is a current problem in America about outsourcing of jobs.
Which is
the government's function to do something about it.
Yeah. See, we do it here differently. We insource it by importing people from Thailand. Which takes away Israeli jobs. We're going to send the work overseas. We bring in foreign workers.
See,
to the same thing.
Won't work for the kind of conditions that
that's right. Okay. Let's. We're way, way far. Let's go back to it. You have a question? Yes.
Claim an award for something for an award that either so foreign to you that you completely discredit it, or you know, without the award. For example, not even like you're aware of the concept of an award outside a particular chemical structure of the world yet.
Okay, this is a very important question, and I haven't said anything about it, so let me talk about it for a couple of minutes. You have to understand that the reward we're talking about is not an external response to what you do. Rather, what you do builds the reward detail by detail. So that, as Ramchal says over and over again, when you get there and you experience the reward, every detail in the reward can be traced to what you did. Here's the example of how it doesn't work and how it does work. Money is how it doesn't work. Because a bus driver and an accountant and a person who designs airplanes and a prize fighter all get money. If you look at the money, You don't see what they did. There's no connection to what they did. It's just an amount. Now contrast that with the following. You receive in the mail a box. A box that's about 3 feet tall, 3 feet wide, and 3 feet deep. A big box. You open it up, and inside there are instructions for building a radio receiver. From scratch. All you get in there is raw materials. And the machines, make it from scratch. You have raw copper into which you have to make wires. You know, and you can design transistors, and you've got microchips that can be designed, so on and so on. And you've got one of these books like the Word Book, you know. The book to operate the program Word is like 1,500 pages long. Why did I buy a computer if I had to read a book? Why did it just work by itself? No. And you have this, and you have your soldering guns and the little tweezers and all the stuff that you need to build this thing. It's going to take you decades to build this thing. And in the end, you go into the world to come with your self-built radio receiver. Now, the world to come is listening to radio. That's what it is. So, when you get there, if when you design the digital tuning in the radio, you follow the instructions faithfully, then it will tune exact. Not within 10 units like my radio tunes, but micro-tuning, you know, to as fine a tuning as you like. So every station will be exact. If, when you built the woofers, you weren't paying attention, you were distracted, or you were tempted to do other things, then it won't woof. You know, it's just going to give you a scratchy bark. Woof, the way woofers should woof. You won't have triple bass. Now, when you listen to that radio receiver for eternity, what you get out of it is what you put into it, detail by detail. So that every quality in the operation of that receiver can be traced to some action or other that you did in building it. Now, the reward that we get there is going to be traceable back to the actions that we did here that way. So it's not external. Of course, I don't know now. I have a picture now about what it is. But I am told that the reward is going to be that way. It's going to be related that way to what I did. Now, in general terms, what it means is you are building, perfecting parts of your soul, parts of your body, which ultimately is a part of your soul. You're perfecting parts of yourself. Those parts of yourself that are enabled to experience God in the ways in which you perfect it. That's an extremely important aspect of the idea of reward. It's not external to what you do. It's built directly by what you do. Yeah.
My question would be is, say you got this box, so you get the manual, and now we have this box on this manual, and you're told what it is.
Okay.
It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Why should it matter? This is the key to your world, the reward of the world to come. It happens to be radio receiver. You don't know that. The lady who listens to the radio says, oh, so it goes tweet, tweet, tweet. That's because when I put these things over here, that's what I was doing. You'll be able to see detail by detail what I was doing. Yeah.
In a different way of putting it, couldn't you say that everything you do, you see how that makes you more like God?
Say over what he said. No. Maybe now I'm going to get stuck. He said, look at the actions you perform. You should be able to see how each of these actions makes you more like God. Let's talk about that for a little bit. What are we doing? We're doing mitzvos. Can we see that the mitzvos make us more God-like? Well, in some cases, we can. In some cases, the mitzvos tell us to do chesed. If they tell us to do chesed, then immediately you know that you're more godly. Sometimes the mitzvos tell us to treat someone else with justice, sometimes even harshly. Okay, God does that sometimes too. that also is a means to chesed or an expression of chesed. So that too could fit under the rubric. Some of the actions that we do don't seem to be related at all. Don't put linen and thread in your clothes. One evening in the spring, eat crackers. I mean, you know, there are various things which hard to see what divine quality they're related to at all. Okay, most of the time, if you push deeply or look deeply, you can find some quality or other that's relevant to making you more godlike. And here's what's bothering me. Being more godlike is having certain qualities, certain characteristics, parts of your character. Being a kind, loving person. Seeking justice. Or performing actions of that kind. But the world to come is described as an experience. There's no action. The qualities of character that you have don't give rise to actions because there are no actions to do. It's described as a kind of experience. So this becoming God-like, this is something else that my son said and told me last week. This quality, becoming God-like, has to be the key to that kind of experience. So, what we have to do is get from being God-like by having qualities of character, that are God-like qualities of character, performing God-like actions, which is the God-likeness that we can acquire in this world. We have to get from that idea to the idea of having, so to speak, the God-like experience. Okay, I will share with you something which I'm working on elsewhere, just to show you how things connect up. Before the creation, God is described by the Ramchal as mispashet besoch atzmuso, which means roughly, the literal words mean he spreads out within his essence, which doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything to us. Whatever that means. And then he says, in the activity of creation, he performs pe'ula. Pe'ula means what we call actions. I'm studying this with somebody, so I called my son. I said, exactly what is Ramchal trying to tell us today? So he said like this. An action is what I've been talking to you over the last week. An action is for the sake of a goal, a purpose. To say that I did X for the sake of purpose Y means that before I did it, I'm missing something. I'm going after Y by doing X. By the way, X and Y could be the same. Doesn't matter. But I'm going after something I don't have. The word action applies to something which is in and of itself missing something. Now, when you use words for what God was before the creation, it's not appropriate to say something like that. So the word action shouldn't apply. On the other hand, you don't want to picture God before the creation as static. So there has to be an intermediary. This spreading within his essence is a way of saying that there's activity there, but it isn't what we call action. It isn't for the sake of a purpose, which means that until you have the purpose, you're missing something. That's the wrong way to describe it. It's activity without external purpose, something like that. Anyway, he told this to me. He said, also, he doesn't really understand it. He's just giving the best ideas, the words he can give to it. Good. So now, that idea becomes very useful to the problem that I was just facing. The problem I'm facing is, how can I describe what's going on in Olam HaBa and the world to come? Since the reward is supposed to be experience, and the God-likeness that we're describing here is action and qualities of character. The answer will be, indeed, God-likeness does express itself in action and quality of character. But it also expresses itself in another way. God-likeness can express itself in the quality of activity that he had before the creation. That quality of activity before the creation is something like experience. And I guess by the actions we perform and the qualities of character that we create for ourselves, we qualify ourselves for that kind of experience. That would be the way to put it together, I guess. At any rate, it was a good question. It's a very good question. And the next time I speak to my son, I'll ask him about it. It's a very, very interesting question. Now, what I'm telling you, what I told you now, comes from another book that Rambam Chal wrote, which is not translated into English. I've said to you a number of times that to make Rambam Chal work, you've got to bring things from one place to the other, because each book is like a snapshot. That's what we start. It's say to you, we're like a snapshot. We started off that way. And here's a very good example of it.
Which book?
What?
The which book has been translated?
Well, there's a whole bunch of them that haven't been translated.
Which book are you saying?
The Pachut. That's what I'm referring to. Also the Asar Pachut. You don't know what they are, then you don't need to know what they are. You know what they are, then that's enough. Anyway, that's the best thing. But there is a problem here. And his question was more of the problem, that in all of all is only experience. So there's got to be a God-like quality of experience. So it's not just doing actions and acquiring character. But that's what we can do here. We can do actions and acquire character, and that has to make us capable of the God-like experience. I think that's the right description. So I'll check it with my son. Yes, everybody with me so far? Okay. I think the next thing we'll talk about is how Adam was before in the Garden of Eden, and then what happened to him afterwards. Free will should be balanced. The choice should be a balanced choice. And that's the way Adam was created. A soul and a body pulling in opposite directions. Balance. And therefore the choice was a really fair choice. Now he failed. As a result of his failure, as I will describe in Mr. Shem, as a result of his failure, the whole world changed its character. We face a much more difficult task than he faced. Fundamentally more difficult. Our choices are not balanced. One little symptom of it is this. If it's a struggle between the soul and the body, notice that Adam was created as an adult. So he was given a fully formed body, a fully formed soul, each mature and ready to work. We go through years in which the body is fully functioning and the soul is not. The body gets an enormous head start. Furthermore, by the way we are created, the body makes enormous demands on the soul. We have to work. Work within the physical environment to provide for ourselves. Adam didn't have to do that. But the idea of the garden, where his physical needs were provided naturally, so he was not immersed in the physical environment. He was just a visitor in the physical environment. but we're immersed in it. So we have two strikes against us before we start. That makes the job much more difficult. Now, what is the project? The project is to succeed at what he failed. So this requires two stages. I'm just giving you the headlines now. I'll go over this all tomorrow. It requires getting back into his condition and then taking the step above his condition that he failed to take. But that's going to be done all on the basis of our effort in this reduced environment. It isn't a two-stage effort, it's a two-stage process. Two-stage process. It's the basis of one stage of effort. We perform the effort here. If we are successful here, that effort will carry us through the second stage automatically. That's not explicitly in our call, but that's the best that people that I respect have understood it. So we are really in a stage of existence very different from that of Adam, as we'll describe tomorrow. And our task is much more difficult. If we succeed here, that will carry us through, including the transformation that should have happened had he chosen correctly.
I have a question that kind of connects both. If what happened in the Garden of Eden, you know, Adam had free will and he chose one way, but God wanted to create this world where, you know, we look back at Adam, you know, did Adam have free will?
I don't say wanted. Why did he say wanted? He wanted to. He was ready to if necessary. He would have been able to handle the world the other way had Adam chosen correctly. Why did he say he wanted to create this world? I mean,